Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, May 12th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, will present its season finale, a John Williams tribute concert, Saturday, May 18th at 7:30 p.m. at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. SONA musicians and singers will perform highlights from movies like Schindler's List, Star Wars, E.T., Jaws, Harry Potter, and more. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, a review of Macklemore's latest album and remembering a great American artist.
And it's that time of year. Spring fever has a way of putting people in the cleaning mood. But a handful of stories from the past week were about more than just cleaning the flotsam and jetsam from one's own personal space. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis gives us the details in his usual Week in Review.
The Fayetteville Housing Authority announced early this week that it has received some federal help to rehabilitate the city's most visible public housing project. The authority received a $3.5 million federal housing and urban development grant to repair and renovate the exterior of Hillcrest Towers in downtown Fayetteville. Frida Sawin is the executive director of the Fayetteville Housing Authority.
It will be used to restore the outside of our building where the brick has maybe come loose and there are some leaching going on through the mortar system. And it's right at the very tops of our building, and this kind of happened when the building was built, and we're just making sure that none of that brick is going to be a danger to anybody and fall off the building, and it's going to be secured. We're going to secure it and make sure that it will last for another, hopefully, 40 years.
Sawin says that maintaining current public housing facilities is of utmost importance, as no new public housing is being built.
The government's not giving funds for that, and what we do get is a capital fund grant every year to keep what we've got up and repaired. But this grant is an emergency grant because this building is such a big building, and it serves a good purpose, and there is a need to make sure that we make it to where it will last longer than the 40 years that it was supposed to.
The building was constructed in the early 1970s. Sawin says the exterior rehabilitation work, including resealing mortar and balconies, roof work, and installation of new balcony railings, will take 1 to 2 years to complete. In Benton County, last month's rain showers caused several $100,000 worth of damage to county roads. Robert McGowan, the director of Benton County Emergency Management, said earlier in the week that the agency, along with the County Road Department and Arkansas Department of Emergency Management, had completed an assessment of the damage done during the April showers.
The unincorporated areas of Benton County, we found 126 sites that were in need of repair, and based on the preliminary assessments, we believe that will cost over $700,000 to make all those repairs.
McGowan says that the damage was widespread throughout the unincorporated parts of the county and that, as a result, the necessary repairs will be varied in nature.
We have low water slabs that have to be replaced. I believe there's about 10 low water slabs that have to be taken out and replaced. We have CMPs, which is corrugated metal pipes, which help the water flow under the road. There was such a high velocity of water flow, they washed those out. Some of them were damaged, they have to be replaced. In other areas, the road was just basically washed away, and they're having to haul in dirt to build it back to what the pre-disaster condition is.
McGowan says that the county has 9 months to complete the work. After that, county officials will have 3 months to submit paperwork to the state for a 35% reimbursement of the actual cost of the repairs. But following storms and flash flooding late in the week, County Judge Bob Kleinard reportedly declared the county a disaster zone after many roads were closed because of flooding. Fort Smith residents will soon pay less for sanitation services. This week, the City Board of Directors approved the decrease that will take effect July 1st. Baridi Noko-Kaley, the city's sanitation director, says that the rate decrease is possible because of savings gleaned from automating trash collection for the entire city.
As a result of the efficiencies we've realized over the past 7 years, I told the board then that if they would, in fact, allow me to automate the remaining households, which at that time was about 4,100, that we felt that we would realize enough benefit from the efficiencies and cost effectiveness of the program that I actually could offer a rate decrease. We calculated it last year and it came out to be about $1.10 per month. and we put it in the budget.
While the rate decrease is possible now, Noko Kaley says costs associated with solid waste collections are ever increasing, especially when accounting for costs such as equipment, fuel, personnel, and even replacement and repair of trash carts.
I expect that we'll be able to maintain this reduction in rate for a minimum of 2 years. And what I was very specific about is that although the automated refuse or mechanized method of collecting trash recyclables in the city has offered us benefits in the reduction of personnel injuries, turnover rate, we can do more work with the same amount of personnel, and of course we didn't have to lay off anyone. We still have those increasing costs, so it's basically a hedge to sort of help us to better manage the ever-increasing costs.
Not only is trash collection automated, but Noko Kaley says that the city is beginning the process of automating collection of recyclables, and he hopes to automate the collection of yard waste by 2016. Yesterday, the city of Bentonville took part in the Great American Cleanup with a citywide cleanup of its own. Danielle Chastain, Community Programs Coordinator for the City of Bentonville, says that the cleanup targeted cleaning along streets throughout the city.
Our parks are pretty clean, and our trails are pretty clean, too. So it's usually just along the city streets with construction debris and all the wind and everything. And usually at major intersections, there's lots of trash, too, from people throwing trash out their car window while sitting at a stoplight.
Chastain says that the Great American Cleanup is a national campaign that normally takes place between the months of March and May, and that Bentonville normally holds its citywide cleanup during May because the weather is usually more favorable than in March or April. And finally, from clean streets, we go to clean energy. A group of students from the University of Arkansas took home $250,000 from the MIT Clean Energy Competition early this week. The team's startup company, Pika Solar, considerably improved efficiency in solar cells. The competition's director, Samuel Shaner, says Pika Solar could continue its success in the business world.
So many of the teams in our competition are ready to go, and as we've seen in past years, we've had over 100 teams in the competition, and from that developed 28 real strong energy companies that gone on to raise over $100 million in capital. So I think them and several other teams in the competition are going to develop into successful ventures.
Shaner says the competition provides critical mentorships and relationships between government, business, and students.
One of the key aspects of it is access and mentorship. In addition to just having them network with these companies, we also assign an entrepreneurial, a legal, and an industry mentor to help them navigate the many challenges of starting an energy company.
Pika Solar will move on to the final round of competition this June in Washington, D.C. From the Herald and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Normally, when we walk into a store, we see price tags on every product. And those prices don't change in front of our eyes based on other items that we've picked up. But researchers in the Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas have found out that could change.
So sequential pricing is, in essence, where a seller is setting the prices on products in a sequential manner after they observe how buyers are interacting or making their selections.
That's Carrie Deck, professor of economics and co-author of a new study. The study shows the use of sequential pricing as opposed to simultaneous pricing could increase profits for retailers. Think about if you're shopping online. A consumer clicks on an item. Whether or not they choose to purchase that item, the store is able to record information about that consumer and their preferences. Based on that information, the store can then set prices on other items the consumer might be interested in. It makes sense for an online retailer, but how will it work in a physical bricks-and-mortar store? As Jean Elijas, professor in the Supply Chain Management Department, formerly of Information Systems, says we'll have to train customers into thinking that it's no different than online. He says this is the neat part.
And RFID, and this was Carrie's idea, provides the ability for a retailer to monitor a customer and to learn things about their preferences by observing their behavior. Now, previously, a lot of research and practice has been focused on retailers monitoring inventory. So this is a slight new twist. So we're taking this technology, which has traditionally been used behind the scenes, and we're putting it into a customer-facing technology.
But specifically, how will it work? Here's Carrie Deck.
So you might have like a smart shopping cart, and so as you're going through the shelf, the RFID tag just shows you on your display, oh, these items are this. You might think about them telling you things about, recommendations for other items that you might like, maybe sourcing information if you're concerned about what the carbon footprint of this product is, right? I mean, they can do all kinds of information more tailored to you. And so, potentially somebody who picks up this kind of a product may want to know about the carbon footprint of the things that they're seeing and looking at the store. Someone else who's doing this may want some other form of information about it. And so you'd be able to tailor information. You could think about automating, displays in the store, music. There's really no limit to what you could do.
Essentially, once that information's there, the store can do whatever they want with it. Elijah says there's a notion of what customers are willing to accept. It's an implementation issue, which they didn't really provide the framework for in this study. He says sequential pricing will work better in some stores with certain products than in others.
All right, so some prototypical examples would be books, because you see this all the time. On Amazon, for example, you're going to get discounts for books, you're going to get free shipping, you're going to get other means of prices changing on you. So that would be one little example of where people are, I believe, already conditioned to accept a change in price. Carrie, would you agree on that?
I think books is a good example in where you might see this kind of thing, because if you think about what happens when you decide to look through a book, it tells the seller that this is a topic or an area that you're interested in. And so the mere fact that you've selected this book and put it in your shopping cart, or that you've spent the time to flip through it, tells them something about the types of books that you're going to like. And so now when you see a different book, they have a better idea of whether or not that's a book that you really are going to like, or it's a book that you may not like. And so what they can do is say, well, we have this high price on these books, but once we know that you probably don't like it or are less likely to like it, we can offer you a coupon to induce you to come and purchase it.
Whereas somebody else who the seller believes has a high value for the book, they don't have to offer them the coupon. The place where sequential pricing has the most value is where buyers have a positively correlated value for two goods. If I like one book, then I'll like the second book. It will also work where products are close substitutes, say one pair of jeans and another pair of jeans. Maybe it's the fact that it's springtime, but I wanted to know if it would work in a home goods store, a place like Lowe's or Home Depot.
So, well, yeah, right. So if you're buying, a weed eater product, that's going to tell Lowe's something about the types of projects that you're currently working on, the level and kind of the power rating of what you're looking for. Are you looking for industrial strength things? Or are you looking for something kind of light to do easy work around, a small patio or something, right? Once they know that, that adjusts, what they expect the other items that you may be looking at, what you may purchase.
So it will work in a different situation. This for complement goods. As Elijah's mentioned earlier, RFID technology is already being used in a lot of large retailers for things like inventory control and loss prevention, all behind the scenes, which consumers don't see. So when will we be able to see this, the use of RFID technology in sequential pricing?
And this is where it's almost free to then start using it for customer-facing applications. And that's what I really find exciting about this research on the pricing, because this is a way that we can take this technology that's already in the store and then use it for another application. And comparatively speaking, the cost is going to be relatively low.
Larger retailers will be able to implement more quickly and easily than smaller stores, but the technology will eventually become less expensive. Elijah says the tagging of individual products is one of the most expensive parts, and if the suppliers did the tagging, the cost would be lowered. So at that point, when all retailers, large and small, have the technology to do sequential pricing inside the store, what does that do for competition?
So I think the competition story is really more, what does competition do to this? And so actually we have a follow-up study where we look at what the impact of competition might be. And so what we actually find is that while the ability to do this type of sequential pricing is profit enhancing to the seller when they have kind of a monopoly power captive audience, once you introduce the competition, the ability to implement this is greatly weakened.
The seller has to set a price on the first product to segment those that have a high value for the product and those that have a low value for it. Then they use that info to set prices on the other items. If you're competing to get customers inside the store, you have to have a lower price. You're getting less segmentation and less information about who has a high value and who has a low value. If things were priced as low as they could, there's no information to gather because everyone will buy it.
Dependent upon what the competition in that particular market looks like. And so to the degree that people are price sensitive, that they're comparison shopping, that there's alternatives out there, it's going to limit the amount of information that a seller is able to extract.
Elijah says that this idea of targeted marketing, engaging with the customers in the store, is huge. He says it's almost the holy grail of retail.
You know, when you think about it, this has always been the case. You know, 2,000 years ago, I'm pretty sure that when someone walked into an open-air market, the guy who was trying to sell stuff would take a look at the customer, try to get a feel for what they might like, and then maybe engage in a little sequential pricing, so to speak, right? But now the big difference, and once again, this is Carrie's term for it, so I'm going to quote him, it's all about scale.
All of a sudden, you can take this notion that has been around forever and take it into the context of modern retail. Automate it, and suddenly it's an option for everyone. It's like having omniscient presence with eyes and decision makers all over the store.
Now that's just mind-blowing to me.
Carrie Dack and John Elijahs are professors in the Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Their study on sequential pricing was published in the journal Information Systems Research. It can also be found online. This is Ozarks at Large.
And as we mentioned earlier in the program, this week a graduate business plan originating at the University of Arkansas won the big prize in the MIT NSTAR Clean Energy Prize competition in Boston. Pika Solar, the winning team, won for a business plan built around a patent-pending process developed by one of its members to improve the efficiency of solar cells. Trish Flanagan is the president of Pika Solar, and right now she's with me on the phone. Trish, thanks for taking a few minutes today.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, let me ask you, what was the competition like at MIT? How did that work?
Well, it was really exciting to be in MIT, at MIT in Boston, because, you know, there are a lot of teams there that had a lot of really great ideas, a few other solar plays. It was a fun time being around all the energy, around renewable energy.
The big prize, when it was all totaled, it was $250,000.
Right. Yeah, so the Department of Energy was very generous in sort of supporting us in our idea and our business, as well as NSTAR, so a local utility company. And so that was really exciting to be validated by both those important and impressive organizations.
When you throw in the amount of money won when you picked up the grand prize at the Donald W. Reynolds Cup in Little Rock earlier this spring, more than $300,000 raised this spring, what can that money mean?
That money can mean that we can pay ourselves.
That's always nice.
Yeah, so we're excited about that. Hey, you know, just mostly the sort of nuts and bolts of our operation. We've got a lot of partners who, of course, have we've got operational expenses that we would need to take care of as far as engaging our partners and making it feasible for them to begin helping us, you know, really getting our technology ready for market.
Now, from what I understand about the technology that was invented by team members like Seth Shumate, is that it increases the efficiency of solar cells by perhaps up to 15%?
Yes, exactly. So we're working on it. We've tested it, proven it in our lab time and time again. In fact, exceeded our expectations for that efficiency boost, but we know that, you know, there's still a number of technical hurdles that we have to overcome and milestones that we have to meet. And so, you know, this sort of money helps us get a boost in that direction, and, you know, as well as, you know, fundraising to be able to access the equipment and the personnel that we need to get our process proven as quickly as possible on an industrial scale.
I think I did the first interview or story about solar cells more than 20 years ago. And what I had heard then and many of the stories I've done since is that, you know, solar can take off, but it's got to be improved. The efficiency's got to be improved. You could be, and I'm no scientist, but you could be on the cusp of something very big here.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's what's so exciting for us, is, you know, and that's what we're really chomping at the bit to get this thing, you know, to get our technology pushed through and to, you know, prove it over and over again, prove the reliability of it, prove the longevity of it, you know, in an external environment, which is necessary. You know, right after we won the competition, we met up with some of our research partners and, you know, just basically laid out what the cost would be and what the timeline would be to get the technology to the various stages, you know, that we need to. So we're really excited. You know, it's kind of this paradigm of developing the business as at the same time as developing the technology. So it's kind of going, you know, which goes first. We're a tech. Our technology is our baby, and so we're really committed to that. We want to make sure that the product that we're offering is exactly what we say it is, and that we can stand behind it 100%. So for us, the R&D is a top priority right now.
Obviously, the money you've won this spring, as you mentioned, helps you pay yourselves for your work. But what does the sort of stamp on the resume that you've won this MIT competition, does that help open doors to potential investors?
Well, you know, that's one of the exciting things, I think, for us as entrepreneurs, is that you pave your own way, right? I mean, it is a matter of, I mean, there's a lot of luck involved, I'd say. But certainly an amount of hard work. And I think for us, you know, like you said, unlocking this technology that could essentially change the game of energy. That's sort of says much more for us as individuals, I would say, than on our resume. But certainly to have that validation, like I said, of the community at MIT and, you know, Department of Energy, this is a huge step for us in really getting solar to turn things around for us. And, you know, our motto is we're an investment in our energy future, or at least the next 10 years. And we really believe that.
And also, Arkansas, a small state, and we tend to take big pride in when someone does well. Have you heard from many people back here?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, everyone. In fact, I had my last exam this morning. You know, I'm finishing up my degrees this week. And, round of applause. So everyone's really excited. I think even people in Boston, when we were sort of celebrating and talking with people, they were excited that, you know, the farm kids from out of nowhere came up to the big show and took it home. So, yeah, I think we're drumming up a lot of excitement about the competition, but mostly, you know, about solar, about clean energy.
Trish Flanagan is the president of Pika Solar. Trish, thanks for your time and congratulations again on the prize.
Thanks very much.
Charles Banks Wilson, an American artist, was laid to rest on Tuesday in his hometown of Miama, Oklahoma. Born in Springdale in 1918, he maintained his ties to Arkansas throughout his 94 years as a painter, printmaker, teacher, lecturer, historian, magazine and book illustrator. He died in Rogers. The artist is most known for his paintings of American Indians. Wilson's works are housed in some of the most renowned museums and art galleries in the world, including New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, Washington's Library of Congress, the Oklahoma State Capitol, where 4 13-feet-tall and 27-feet-wide murals lie in the rotunda. The Gilcrease Museum owns, according to the artist, over 300 pieces of his work. We here at Ozarks were lucky enough to speak with Wilson a number of times over the years. Excerpts you will hear in this report are from interviews conducted in 2006 and 2011.
The earliest memory I have was about when I was about tall enough to lay on my back and paint under my mother's kitchen table, because there was a great big white space, and that probably was my first mural. I used to draw on everything. But people would, when I got older, would say things like, gee, you have a lot of talent, or something like that. And I didn't know what they're talking about, because I thought everybody drew.
Not everyone does draw. Not like Wilson, who at 15 drew a portrait of Will Rogers. Growing up in Oklahoma, Wilson was surrounded by cowboys and Indians. As he grew into his career, he painted only what he called pureblood Indians, those that can trace their ancestry to only one tribe. The artist describes one of his works.
I think probably the best painting I ever did is this one behind you of the Indian. He was a pureblood Quapaw. That white decoration on his body would have extended on up the face, but I thought the face was just too good to clutter with that design, so I left it that way.
Wilson said he painted for himself, for fun. He described himself as an observer, a watcher, saying, I just came to watch. One of his paintings, owned by the Gilcrease, is titled Some Just Come to Watch. His success could be attributed to that characteristic. Documentarian Larry Foley produced a 30-minute film, Charles Banks, A Portrait of American Artist, in 2006. In an interview in that same year, he spoke of meeting that artist for the first time.
I met Charles, I believe it was in 2001, and I was doing some visual research for a documentary called The Forgotten Expedition. And I did a search, a little internet search, and lo and behold, I came upon an image called Osage Dreams by Charles Banks Wilson. And I went over and visited with him and was just captivated, not just by his art and his friendliness and his willingness to give me whatever I wanted, but the stories of his life. And I think I thought at that moment that this man has a story worth telling, and I'd like to tell it.
In making the film, Foley says he did what he teaches: tell the story the way it is. The film is his relationship with Wilson, intimate conversations with the artist. Foley's admiration for the man is quite evident.
Charles spent much of his life in Oklahoma, but he was born in Arkansas and he's lived back here since 1989, so he sort of belongs to all of us. He's just a robust character and one of the favorite subjects that I've ever covered in my entire career.
Wilson was 83 and 93, respectively, when the interviews were recorded. And understandably so, one can tell the artist was coming to terms with his career and his mortality.
If I could live it all over again, and I was just thinking the other day about I'm doing this program on my life in 30 minutes, and I actually have been drawing and painting for 72 years. How do you condense 72 years of career in 30 minutes? That'll shake you up. But I'm very happy with what I've done. I'm afraid if I changed something, it wouldn't be the same, and I don't have any complaints at all.
For some reason, Wilson seemed concerned that the world, his public, might have a complaint, that they don't fully understand his work.
If I wanted to be remembered, I kind of wish that people would appreciate what I've done more than they do now.
Why do you feel that they don't now?
I don't know. I don't know that it's, the now is particularly appropriate. I think I just think that people perhaps wouldn't understand. Maybe understand is a better word than appreciate and all that. Understand. Because I am essentially trying to say something. And you probably hope that people will understand what you're trying to say.
Charles Banks Wilson passed away May 2nd, 2013, in Rogers, Arkansas. The renowned artist painted for much of his 94 years. Wilson admitted to having painted approximately 150 different tribes of Native Americans. The excerpts of his and Larry Foley's voice were taken from interviews conducted for Ozarks at Large in 2006 and 2011. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
It is Sunday, May 12th. Happy Mother's Day. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us on the phone from Kansas is Becca Martin Brown, features editor from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
But I have a great Mother's Day present for me.
Okay.
It's that time of year where we get to announce and discuss theater seasons.
Yes.
And the Art Center of the Ozarks is doing one of my favorite plays ever.
Which is?
Death Trap.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Do you know it, Christina?
I don't. I know I've heard of it, but I'm not really, really familiar with it.
The movie featured Christopher Reeve and Michael Caine. The story about a foundering author who finds a way to get a successful new book written, or play, I'm not sure which. And then it turns out that nothing is as it seems.
It never is.
And it's going in the after Christmas slot at the Art Center of the Ozarks, where they usually do mysteries.
Well, that fits.
But before that, the summer musical, which opens July 12th, is Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Mm-hmm.
Followed by one of the funniest plays ever written, Larry Shoes the Nerd.
Oh, yes.
Shoes and Socks. If you know the show, you know why that's funny. It's a story about somebody who comes to visit and won't go away.
Right.
And then you can, if you can follow a farce with a farce, why not? They're doing No Sex, Please, We're British.
That's familiar.
Another door slammer about an assistant bank manager and his wife who orders Scandinavian glassware in the mail, and it turns out to be Scandinavian pornography.
And hilarity ensues.
Exactly. And then, of course, they'll do the best Christmas pageant ever, which is so popular they'll have to do it forever.
Uh-huh.
And rounding out the season after Death Trap is Blithe Spirit.
Oh. Blithe
Spirit. One of the sweetest, funniest. It's about a writer whose first wife won't go away even though she's dead.
A comedy.
Yes, a comedy.
Yes.
So they have a few comedies this season.
So it's going to be a fun season at the Art Center of the Ozarks. Now, if you're looking for something to do this afternoon for Mother's Day, mm-hmm. 2 o'clock at the University of Arkansas Global Campus Auditorium on the Fayetteville Square, The Little Mermaid, presented by Arts Live Theater.
Right.
2 o'clock at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium, a free concert by American Indian flutist John Tuhawks, his tribute to mothers that he does many years.
And mothers are in free, I believe.
Everybody's in free.
Well, that would include mothers.
I was going to say, do you have to bring your kids to prove that you're a mother?
No.
I can borrow. Oh, wait, I have a kid.
There you go.
Yeah.
And she still likes kid stuff, which is wonderful.
I still like kids.
2 o'clock at the Walton Art Center in Fayetteville. We're going on a bear hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Almost free, $5. And 4 o'clock at Acoustic Mud in Bella Vista, Tableside Theater presents Murder on the Oriental Rug.
That's kind of Agatha Christie.
I love the title. And for $25, you get a play and dessert.
All right. That's a deal.
Yummy.
So it sounds like a great time, and happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there.
Absolutely. Thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Tomorrow on your edition of Monday Ozarks at Large, conversation I had with Stephanie Schulte.
Right.
About her book called Cached, Decoding the Internet and Global Popular Culture. A sneak preview of that in a moment. But it inspired this week's montage about computers in pop culture.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
Now, in the past couple of weeks, I've been working on a small experiment, which is intended to show how we can be replaced by a computer.
Hey, this may be a way of getting rid of Dean Higgins.
We live in hope, Dexter.
You're wondering who I am.
Secret, secret. I've got a secret.
machine or mannequin.
Secret, secret, I've got a secret.
With parts made in Japan.
Secret, secret.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
You broke a promise to me. Do you know everybody down here in research has been fired?
The whole darn building's been fired. That crazy fool machine of yours in payroll went berserk this morning and gave everybody a pink slip.
No kidding. Oh, but that's impossible. It just couldn't happen.
You've got mail.
You have part of my attention. You have the minimum amount. The rest of my attention is back at the offices of Facebook, where my colleagues and I are doing things that no one in this room, including and especially your clients, are intellectually or creatively capable of doing. Did I adequately answer your condescending question?
I've got a little challenge for you, Sark. A new recruit. He's a tough case, but I want him treated in the usual manner. Train him for the games, let him hope for a while, and blow him away.
If you'd like to see the identification of the 10 features inside this morning's montage, of course, you can go to ozarksatlarge.com. And I mentioned the interview with Stephanie Schulte about her book, Cached, Decoding the Internet and Global Popular Culture. One of the cuts we heard in the montage figured prominently, perhaps more prominently than you thought, in how America and the world perceived the earliest days of the Internet.
A lot of researchers have sort of talked about the internet as having two parents, as having this parent in the military, which, you know, makes a lot of sense because the internet was funded by NASA funding. So the same funding packet that funded NASA funded the internet. And then also its second parent being the counterculture. So the 70s and 80s counterculture, hippies really were the cultural arm of the internet. And War Games really shows you those two sides in a kind of powerful way.
And War Games, and then some other images that came up that were often used not just by the entertainment industry, but sometimes the nightly news and the news weeklies showed the protagonists or the people who are with computers as sort of outsiders, messy bedrooms, this sort of idea that not quite could be trusted. Because as you said, computers weren't really in the homes yet, let alone the office.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the computers were mostly used by teenagers in basements playing video games and used for entertainment purposes at that point. And I think that's part of the reason why it was sort of menacing in some ways. We connected it to changing of the guard fears about kids these days, right? And, you know, merged those with fears that we had about Cold War, and evils lurking.
And War Games was screened, or at least part of it was screened on the Senate floor?
Yeah, in committee. Yeah, the first legal policies about the internet happened in the wake of that movie, and it was the Computer Fraud Act, which is the policy that was recently used to indict Aaron Schwartz, and the senators were responding to a number of hacks that happened, and they actually watched War Games as part of research, which I thought was quite fascinating. That was actually one of the sparks for writing the whole book, was actually making that discovery and realizing that had happened.
That conversation, plus a honey tasting that you had with some of our colleagues and
Dr. Donald Steinkraus, yeah.
That and more on tomorrow's edition of Daily Ozarks at Large at noon.
I'm Bob Garfield, and on this week's On the Media, we ask, can the current golden age of content last as the stuff we love migrates online where nothing earns much?
The question is, will the 12-year-old of today pay some amount of money per month to get something like Game of Thrones 10 or 20 years from now?
The sustainability of content in the digital age, on the next On the Media from WNYC.
On the Media, just ahead this morning at 11 o'clock here on KUAF. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Today is Mother's Day. Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Motes has been a mother for a few years now, and she's thinking this weekend about the traditions of Mother's Day.
In old photo albums and shoeboxes, there are several photos of my mother and her mother wearing corsages on Mother's Day. Usually they're standing in front of the lilac bush or the deep purple irises, my mother wearing a red corsage and her mother a white one. I distinctly remember my mother explaining the tradition to me one Sunday morning as we were sitting in the old Church of Christ building on Union Street in Dardanelle. Red corsages were worn by women whose mothers were still living, she explained. Women who had lost their mothers wore white. Looking over at my grandmother, Golda Faye Taylor McRoy, who must have been nearing 70 at the time, I thought about what her white corsage meant. I began to realize that she hadn't always been my grandmother. She was once a young woman with a living mother, and before that, a young child like myself. I remember wondering if she missed her mother, and I began to ponder how long it had been since she'd worn a red flower. Then I looked around at the rest of the congregation, and I noticed just how many other women were also wearing white flowers, some of them even young, like the age of my mother. Pinned on all their dresses, these simple flowers spoke volumes about the aging process, the continuity and complexity of motherhood, and the mysteries we carry with us. I remember wondering if I'd ever wear a red flower of my own. Turns out I never did. My mother died before my own children were born, so these days I wear white too. Wearing a flower for Mother's Day isn't the popular tradition it once was, nor does it even date back to the founding of Mother's Day, which began with an Appalachian woman named Anna Jarvis. In 1858, she called for the creation of what she dubbed Mother's Work Days to bring people together to improve sanitation and clean up the polluted waterways in the region, which were leading to many needless deaths. Nearly two decades later in Boston, poet, suffragist, and staunch pacifist Julia Ward Howe asked mothers to fight for peace. Falling on the heels of the bloody Franco-Prussian War, Howe called for a special day to bring mothers together to organize against further wars. But it wasn't until many years later that Mother's Day became recognized as an official holiday. Anna Jarvis's daughter, also named Anna, recalled her mother once saying, quote, "I hope and pray that someone, sometime, will found a memorial Mother's Day. There are many days for men, but none for mothers," end quote. The younger Jarvis sought to honor her mother's activism and began to push for such a holiday throughout West Virginia and beyond. In 1914, President Woodrow Wilson designated the second Sunday in May as the official Mother's Day. According to historians, it deeply troubled the younger Anna Jarvis that the holiday became commercialized, and she actively fought against this commercialization until her death. Each family, each community, has their own way of celebrating Mother's Day, and subsequent generations will form traditions of their own. What about you? Do you wear a corsage? Do you visit cemeteries for Decoration Day on Mother's Day or engage in any kind of other community work? Do you have shoeboxes full of pictures of your own family wearing Mother's Day corsages? I'd love to hear your stories. You can visit me online and find more information about Julia Ward Howe, both Anna Jarvis's, and photos of corsages past at boildownjuice.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin Moats.
This week on an edition of Daily Ozarks at Large on KUAF, our colleague Antoinette Grajeda had a review of Macklemore's album, The Heist.
It was 99 cents. Copping it, washing it, about to go and get some compliments, passing up on those moccasins. Someone else has been walking in by me and grungy f***ing men. I am stunting and flossing and saving my money, and I'm hella happy that's a bargain. Whoa. I'ma take your grandpa style. I'ma take your grandpa style. No, for real. Ask your grandpa, can I have his hand-me-down? Your Lord jumpsuit and some house slippers. Dookie brown leather jacket that I found. Dig it.
The first time I heard Macklemore's Thrift Shop on the radio, I thought it was a joke. Not that it was a bad song. In fact, it was quite clever. But rather that it was some sort of gimmick. I quickly recalled a link on a friend's Facebook page to the song's video, so I assumed it was the result of someone's creative boredom going viral on YouTube, or perhaps a new artist who had just created his first one-hit wonder. While tuning into Saturday Night Live sometime later, I saw Macklemore and Ryan Lewis perform Can't Hold Us, another single from the album, and realized there was something more than a one-hit wonder there. Trust me, on my I-N-D-E-P-E-N-D-E-N-T, it's hustling, chasing dreams since I was 14, with the four-track busting, halfway across that city with the back, crushing, labels out here, now they can't tell me nothing, we give that to the people, spread it across the country, labels out here, now they can't tell me nothing, we give it to the people, spread it across the country. Here we go back, this is the moment, tonight is the night, we'll fight to rapper Macklemore, whose given name is Ben Haggerty, worked with producer Ryan Lewis to create the album titled The Heist. Macklemore released his first album, Language of My World, in 2005. According to the artist's website, after several subsequent years of artistic stagnation and frustration due to substance abuse, Macklemore made a commitment to sobriety with a newfound dedication to his music. This led to a partnership and ongoing collaboration with Ryan Lewis, who produced The Heist. Can't Hold Us is an excellent example of the layered sounds that make up several of the 15 tracks on the album. Throughout The Heist, you'll hear a wide range of instruments, including trumpet, violin, piano, drums, guitar, bass, and even some banjo. While you oftentimes hear several different instruments all at once, the musicians have managed to arrange them in such a way that it works. Instead of sounding like a disjointed cacophony, you have varied melodies that are each unique and interesting. That's not to say Macklemore doesn't understand the power of simplicity, which is evident in Same Love, where the first verse features mostly piano and Macklemore's lyrics.
When I was in the third grade, I thought that I was gay, 'cause I could draw. My uncle was, and I kept my room straight. I told my mom, tears rushing down my face. She's like, Ben, you've loved girls since before pre-K. Tripping. Yeah, I guess she had a point, didn't she? Bunch of stereotypes all in my head. I remember doing the math, like, yeah, I'm good at Little League.
Same Love addresses same-sex marriage, and it's just one of the issues discussed on the album. While The Heist features some more lighthearted topics like the 24s on an off-black Cadillac in White Walls, The Heist also includes references to artist Keith Haring and author Malcolm Gladwell in 10,000 Hours, and the rapper's struggle with sobriety, which is highlighted in Starting Over.
What pain looks like when you tell your dad you relapsed, to look him directly into his face. The seat on your shoulders, deceivingly heavy weight. Haven't seen tears like this on my girl in a while. The trust that I once built and betrayed. But I'd rather live telling the truth than be judged for my mistakes, than falsely held up, giving props, loved, and praised. I guess I gotta get this on the page. Feeling sick and helpless, lost the compass where soap is. I know what I gotta do, and I can't help it. One day at a time is what they tell us. Now I gotta find a way to tell them.
Macklemore is skilled in his use of lyrics, but he's also not afraid of just letting the music do the talking like he does in Bomb Bomb. This entirely instrumental track features the Seattle-based trio The Teaching, one of many artists featured on the record. In fact, 11 of the album's 15 tracks feature collaborations with other musicians. While 15 songs can be a lot to listen to in one sitting, especially in our increasingly busy lives, should you be able to squeeze in a few tracks between this appointment and the next, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis's The Heist has an entire album full of music that will incite toe-tapping, heartstring pulling, or simply thinking more deeply about an issue, depending on which track you cue up. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And we drink and get older, and some of us even try to get sober. Now here's to the assholes and the last calls. We're city kids, you get what you asked for.
The artist is Macklemore. The CD is titled The Heist. The review from Antoinette Grajeda.
The Artist Fair Festival Orchestra of 2012 performed Brahms Symphony No. 1 in C minor, Opus 68, for their season finale last year. Hi, I'm Katie Hendrickson, host of the KUAF Sunday Symphony, which airs Sunday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Join me for a broadcast of Brahms Symphony No. 1 in C minor, Opus 68, performed by the Artist Fair Festival Orchestra 2012, led by Corrado Brevares. That's paired with Elgar's Symphony No. 2, Opus 63, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Leonard Slatkin. That's coming up on the KUAF Sunday Symphony Sunday night from 7 to 9 p.m. on your public radio station, KUAF.
And as it is almost the middle of May, Artist Fair is well underway.
Yes, it is.
So, and on June 24th, did want to mention that they will be performing at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art.
That's the Artist Fair Orchestra, right. Yes.
And it is not open to the public.
No, very limited seating.
Right, right. However, we will be broadcasting it live.
Yeah. Absolutely live on the air Monday night, June 24th.
Right.
Katie Hendrickson and I will be co-hosting the live portion, and then the orchestra will take over for the rest.
Right. That is at 8 o'clock that evening.
That's correct. It's very exciting.
Right.
Very exciting.
It's one of the things we like to try to do here.
Yes.
We're trying to do more live shows.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I'm looking forward to that a little over a month away.
Yep. Very exciting.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Lakeview.
Lakeview.
I'm cheating.
Isn't that where you're?
That's where my mom is.
I know. I'm like, that sounds way too familiar.
So that's a cheat because it's not in our listening area. And you could say, except it is if you have the internet. But trust me, my mom does not have the web.
Right.
And she's no.
And I know when you go visit your mother that the internet is very limited.
If I go to the top of the driveway, I can get it. Actually, 4G is now available inside the house sometimes. I don't know if it's – the leaves have budded out, so maybe I won't be able to be in contact. I don't know. But, yeah.
All right. Well, this afternoon we will say goodbye to somebody that's been here at KUAF for, I don't know, a couple of years maybe.
Yeah.
Jonathan Schlois.
Is leaving. He's graduating.
Mm-hmm. And you just heard his voice actually during Weekend Edition,
that's
which
right.
was on just before Weekend Ozarks at Large.
We'll miss him.
We will
very
miss
much.
Him.
I'm happy that he's got his degree and that he has a sweet internship in Seattle, Washington with the Post Intelligencer are there doing stuff that he likes with the web and web reporting. So I'm very happy for him, but we will miss him dearly.
Right.
So congratulations and best of luck to John. Tomorrow, you will be hosting Daily Ozarks at Large.
I will be.
And as we mentioned before in the show, Don Steinkraus, entomologist, Dr. Don Steinkraus, brought in honey from different bees.
He did. He's
for
always
tasting.
I talk to him once a month for when I host the Monday show, and he always is just so prepared.
Yeah.
And I mean, he came in with a tub full of different honeys. He had crackers for us to cleanse our palates, and water. And he's great.
Excellent. That'll be on my conversation with Stephanie Schulte from the University of Arkansas about her book, Cached, about the history of global culture and the internet. We'll be on. We'll have Roby Brock's Week in Review, of course. Big show, big brand new show tomorrow at noon.
Right. All right. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellams. Happy Mother's Day.
Have a good Sunday.